We are resuming our series on Christian apologetics in a post-Christian age, and we were talking the last couple of weeks about the notion of common ground and presuppositions, and we have seen that this is one of the areas of dispute, especially within the Reformed tradition, over how much we actually have in common with non-Christians, and if in fact we have anything in common at all. And there are a number of Reformed apologists who emphasize the discontinuity between Christian ways of thinking and non-Christian ways of thinking, to the point that common ground is virtually denied. And you'll have Gordon Clark say there is no such thing as common ground. You'll have Dr. Van Til speaking of, unless you presuppose the truth of Christianity, there's no possibility of proving anything at all. And so that's probably right now the majority position, but it's a recent position. Since the 1930s. The classical Reformed tradition has held something much different from that. And if you take a look, for example, at the work of Petrus von Maastricht, who is, like Francis Turretin, one of the two of the greatest Reformed theologians, both Turretin and von Maastricht openly appeal to kind of a Thomistic foundation for the Christian faith, the importance of common ground, natural revelation. And so I tend to be more sympathetic to the classical position than the contemporary presuppositional position, although I do think there's a lot to offer. Van Til has a lot to offer us in terms of the necessity of non-Christians asserting and proving their objections to Christianity in such a way that we can expose them to stealing first principles from Christianity that they in turn must use to try and argue against the Christian faith. So I don't think we want to get into the kind of the in-house fight that many Reformed Christians will embrace between the evidentialists and the presuppositional. I'm more interested in seeing what is valuable from both sides and kind of working it out together. And I think Thomas Reed's approach that I've been mentioning is particularly helpful there for a couple reasons. One is the whole idea of a common sense apologetic kind of moves us closer to the apologetic activity we see in the pages of the New Testament that's non-philosophical. It is not relying on classical proofs for God's existence. It's appealing to the kinds of things that people use in everyday life to make the decisions that they make about how to go to work, whether to vote for this person, what to eat for dinner. Did I eat that? Did I go here yesterday? Very common sense kinds of things. With the test case being Jesus died on a Friday and was raised on Sunday. That's a very common sense kind of test for truth. And everybody who hears that understands what it means and the issues at stake. So that's kind of the point I've been trying to make. Now, we left off last time looking at one of the possible ways to solve this dilemma. E.J. Carnell, who was a prominent apologist in the 60s and 70s, argued for three levels of common ground: a personal level, which is a level of opinion; a scientific level, which is a level of observation, discussion; and then a metaphysical level, which is kind of the ultimate explanatory level of all things. And we saw that Carnell, I think, is helpful here. I think it can be simplified by just speaking of things that are descriptive and things that are normative. Things descriptive are the things that Christians and non-Christians have in common, the world that we share, the facts of experience, the joys and sadness and tragedies of life, the bad stuff in the news, the good stuff in the news, the beauty of Yosemite, the tragedy of a cemetery, you know, all those things we hold in common with non-Christians. What we don't hold in common with them is God's explanation of those things, the normative. When Scripture says things are like this, that's an area where non-Christians and Christians kind of depart ways or have a different understanding. So I think Carnell's on the right track. I think he's pretty helpful here. Now, following this notion of kind of first principles are the things we have to assume and use to know anything at all. First principles are kind of upstream of human experience. I think first principles are even upstream of revelation, which is the point of departure I'd make from Dr. Van Til. I think that first principles have to be used to understand revelation. And God has made us a certain way and equipped us to understand the revelation that he gives. So I think there's something prior to revelation that's just logically and psychologically necessary. So, talking about those first principles, Thomas Reed wrote in an age, pre-modern debate, pre-modern science and philosophical discussion, and that's been brought up to date a little bit by our good friends, whom everyone in the Reformed tradition knows, R.C. Sproul, and John Gerstner. I think Sproul and Gerstner are helpful in a lot of ways here, especially on this question. I tend not to be as pleased as Sproul and Gerstner are with the argument that you have to prove miracles to prove God's existence, that you have to kind of establish that prior. When the apostles approach non-Christians, there's none of that attempt to prove the possibility of miracles. They argue that a resurrection is the miraculous proof of Christianity, and everyone seems to understand what that means without having some sort of formal proof. But I do think Sproul and Gerstner are very helpful here by identifying three things that are part of this normative, or this rather descriptive common ground. So they're going to a little bit of, I think, kind of fleshing out some of the stuff that Thomas Reed had actually argued. Now, in their book, Classical Apologetics, they make the following point. If we consider common ground to mean a common perception and perspective of reality, then obviously no such common ground for discussion exists between believer and unbeliever. So this would be the normative. It isn't there. From the believer's vantage point, every aspect of life, every bit of experience, every dimension of reality is understood and interpreted from a theological perspective. We're Christians. We see things through the eyes of belief. That's just how things are for us. From a different perspective, however, there's common ground, namely the whole of creation. So perhaps one way to illustrate this would be to say that for people like Van Til and Immanuel Kant, where Van Til gets it, the grid is fundamental to the world. So again, to go back to the point I've been harping on, because I think it's really fundamental here, we all see objective reality. We see things in the world, but does our mind impose certain categories on them, categories substantial enough that I'm not sure that Joseph and Mark and Karen and I see the same thing. We see an object, but our mental faculties impose something on our perception so that, are we seeing the same thing? And there's built into Kant here, despite his objections, a certain level of skepticism, because we just never know we're all seeing this, we're all perceiving the same thing. That eminent philosopher Dr. Phil will say, perception is reality. And that's Kant. But then why does he have that person on his show? Because presumably he's able to show them that their perception is wrong, that their perception isn't reality. So the very possibility of having someone like that on his program seems to kind of betray that perceptions aren't ultimate. There's stuff of which those perceptions are made. Let's get back to that. Because if that were not the case, about all he could do is prescribe the medication. So Van Til would say that the grid interprets the world, where I think Reed and others would say, no. We build interpretive grids out of stuff in the world. And we interpret the world using stuff that's prior to the construction of our grid. So Kant, Van Til have it prior, Reed would have it after. That the world is there first, and again, this is back to the classical distinction that philosophers have made between ontology, being, and epistemology, knowing. Van Til wants to merge those two things together. Classic philosophy, classic Reformed prolegomena have separated those and say, wait, whoa. If there was not a world, we couldn't know anything. But the order of knowing is backwards from that. I work with the things I'm given back to the fact that there's a world and a God who made it. So the order of knowing, the order of being are going the opposite direction. That's the point that Sproul and Gerstner presuppose here. So from a believer's vantage point, every bit of life is interpreted theologically. But from a different perspective, they argue there's common ground, the whole of creation. I think that would be the point here. The believer and the unbeliever each have different grids kind of constructed from the world around them. Believer and unbeliever live in the same universe and each sees the same phenomena. Now, I think more importantly, the biblical data supports this kind of formulation because there's a number of passages and texts that make no sense whatsoever unless the apostles are able to find common ground with their audiences. Now, Jesus appealed to fulfilled prophecy to prove that his claims were true. He does this in Luke's gospel. He does it in John 14:11, a passage that's probably worth reading. I used to listen to people lecture and listen for the Bible pages turning. Unfortunately, you can't listen for my electronic device trying to search for an internet signal. So you'll have to just assume I'm flipping pages here when I'm really trying to get to my ESV on my phone, and for some reason it's not cooperating. Ah, there we go, and it now is. So just pretend. So in John 14, verse 11, we have an interesting comment from our Lord who says, "Believe me in that I am in the Father and the Father is in me, or else believe on the account of the works themselves." That Jesus self-attests by doing miraculous things that no one but the Son of God could in fact do. What do the apostles do? Well, in dealing with Jews, when they have common ground with Jews from the Old Testament, what do? They appeal to the Old Testament, fulfill prophecy. They appeal to Jesus' miracles as things foretold in the Old Testament. They especially make appeal to Christ's resurrection. Repeatedly, when Peter is preaching, he will, "You guys know God raised Jesus from the dead." Paul does that as well. A model apologetic is the one we find in Peter's sermon in Acts chapter 2 in Pentecost. In verse 22 of that sermon, to a Jewish audience, he appeals to miracles. That Jesus does certain things that are predicated of the Messiah, and if he's not the Messiah, how can he do these things? And that's why it should immediately strike us as important that the early Jewish defenders of the Jewish faith did not argue that Jesus didn't perform miracles. What did they argue? He did these miracles, Beelzebub, from the power of Satan, or that Jesus was some sort of a sorcerer who deceived people. And this, of course, is a common religious category in Greco-Roman paganism, the idea of a shaman or a miracle worker or whatever, and that's what Jesus was. He was doing this by the power of Satan. In verses 25 through 31, Peter makes an appeal to fulfilled prophecy. The Old Testament predicts that the Son of David would ascend to the Father's right hand and take his place ruling and reigning over all things. That's what Jesus did. He had just ascended into heaven, and Peter appeals to that. And what are the Jews to say? Well, that didn't happen. That's never their response. F.F. Bruce makes a compelling case in his book on the New Testament documents and again in his book on the defense of the gospel in the New Testament, that at every opportunity when a Christian preached the gospel, the Jews present had the means and the motive and the opportunity to prove Jesus' preaching false. All they have to do is produce a dead body. All they have to do is say, "He's buried over there." All they have to do is say, "You know that we saw him dead after you guys claimed he was..." None of that. Instead, they attribute his miraculous power to the devil. Now, by means of these arguments, the apostles sought very simply to show Jews that Christianity is true. And I mean true in the common sense of the word true. There's no complicated philosophical discussion here of whether things are probable or apodictic or the level of certainty is beyond doubt. There's none of that. There's just this common sense use of the fact this thing happened. And everybody listening understands the implications of that. If you're a Jew and Jesus was raised from the dead, he's the Messiah. And all of a sudden the ground opens up under your feet and it's jumped to one side or the other. It's that kind of a test for truth. It's the kind of message that's connected to the gospel. The arguments the apostles use are directly connected to their preaching. This is why I think one way to speak of this is kind of a proclamation defense. The content of their gospel requires the events in that gospel to be true, and true in the ordinary sense of the meaning of that word. Then you have the apostles dealing with Greco-Roman pagans. And in Acts 14 and again in Acts 17, the appeal is to the common knowledge that they already have that God exists. You never see the apostles set up to prove God's existence to the pagans. The apostles know the pagans know God and are simply suppressing that. So their arguments are attempts to kind of pull that knowledge out of them and expose them for being people who are suppressing the truth and unrighteousness. And Paul does a pretty good job of that in Acts 14, again in Acts 17. But in both those sermons, he ends with an appeal to what? The resurrection. So you never find Paul using some sort of a classical proof. There are arguments from contingency in Paul. God made the world, and in him you live and move, you have your being. Your substance depends on God. There are kind of some contingency arguments implied in there, but nothing like a formal proof. You certainly don't have the ontological argument. Yahweh's being none greater than can be conceived. Nothing like that. And you don't have, well, unless you Jews or unless you Greco-Roman pagans adopt Christian presuppositions for the sake of argument, there's no possible proving anything to you at all, which is the Vantillian argument. There's just none of that in the New Testament. It's really much simpler than that. So it should be noted that when you handle passages like that, the presupposition will contest it. And the argument is that such use of Scripture denies the relevancy of saving faith, without which miracles as signs of divine activity are no avail because the non-Christian doesn't understand them as they're intended as signs of faith. So there's a certain bit of truth in that. If you are blind to the truth in the biblical sense, you're going to see Christ perform a miracle, and you're going to do everything in your power to deny that that miracle means what it obviously is pointing to, that Jesus is the Son of God. Now, you can deny it, then you're having to do so evidentially, which you can't. So about all you can do is to attribute that miracle to another source. It's like what happens in the modern courtroom is the attorney says, we don't have the facts on your side, you trash the witness. Well, that's kind of what the Jews are having to do in the pages of the New Testament. They're having to show that the miracle itself really doesn't mean what you think that it means, even though it's denied. Now, one of the things that always kind of puzzled me back when I was in seminary is John Frame would say in class repeatedly that the notorious higher critic existentialist philosopher Rudolf Bultmann, and Bultmann was known for his understanding of much of the New Testament as myth, Bultmann would say that I live in an age of vacuum tubes with radio. I listen to broadcasts from London in my apartment in Germany. How can I believe in a three-storied universe, heaven and earth and hell? That's crazy. So Bultmann's program was to demythologize the New Testament, strip out all the myth and get back to the, as he called, the kernel or the husk. And that was that there was a Jesus, he preached, he was crucified, and his body was eaten by dogs. That's all that we know. So Bultmann and John Warwick Montgomery Frame would say, we both look at the same evidence in the New Testament, and one being a believer and the other not. And so for Montgomery, the Christian, the evidence very clearly pointed to the resurrection as a historical fact. But to Frame for Bultmann, the same evidence pointed to the literary genre of myth. Now, I'd always stick up my hand and say, why is it then that the New Testament department at Westminster spent so much time refuting Bultmann's arguments? I thought that the New Testament guys did a rather very capable and brilliant job of refuting Bultmann and his mishandling of the New Testament from the New Testament data itself. So why on earth would you engage in refutation? Why refute Bultmann so extensively and not instead argue, well, he just has non-Christian presuppositions. What do you expect? Why go into so much time and trouble to show how Bultmann mishandled the New Testament documents and how in the lifetime of the apostles, between the time Christ is raised from the dead and the time they die, there's a generation or so in there, that it's impossible for the genre of myth to develop. Myths can't develop until at least 3, 4, 5 generations. So why spend all that time refuting Bultmann from the page of the text unless there was something that was more fundamental to Bultmann than his methodology, that you could show that his methodology was misusing the data and you could actually take him apart pretty thoroughly. So presuppositions are going to cringe at the notion that the apostles approached unbelievers as though they were neutral toward God, and we are never arguing that they are. Van Til puts it, and I'm quoting, "It has already become plain that this implies a refusal to grant that any area or aspect of reality, any fact or any law of nature of history, can be correctly interpreted except it be seen in the light of the main doctrines of Christianity." So what Van Til is saying is unless you have Christian categories, you can't understand anything. And that fits perfectly with the grid here. You have a Christian grid, the world makes sense. If you don't have a Christian grid, the world makes no sense. When I think there's something more fundamental, and that is the non-Christian has to use the very logic and facts of the world he detests against the Christian faith to argue against it. So he's, in a sense, by arguing against the Christian faith, having to assume that the Christian faith is true. Van Til's right about that. You're talking about ontology. What is? But the order of knowing is different from the order of being. And that's where I think Van Til smudges the things together in a way that kind of confuses the issue and muddies the water quite a bit. So without some sort of common ground then, there's no real possibility of talking to non-Christians. There's a little bit of arguing, yelling, but why spend time convincing them? I think Van Til's right about one very, very fundamental point. It needs to be shouted from the housetops, and that is there is no neutrality here. This is not neutral common ground. It's common, but it ain't neutral. And we'll talk about that here momentarily. The Holy Spirit must call, illumine, and enable the unbeliever to understand the gospel and respond to Christ in faith and repentance. But the non-Christian understands, at least at a cursory level, the descriptive. Does a non-Christian understand what's meant by Jesus dying and rising again from the dead? You bet they do. And what makes their resistance so great is they do understand and they don't like it. It's offensive to them. It's like rubbing a cat's fur the wrong way. It just, it's just wrong. It goes against the grain, to put it in a rather crude illustration. The non-Christian understands the meaning and the implication of the death and resurrection of Christ. And they reject the message because it offends them, not because there's insufficient evidence for it. I think we want to be real careful not to let the non-Christian off the hook and say, look, there's just no possibility of you understanding this because you have non-Christian presuppositions. I think it's better to say, of course you understand it. And it hangs over you like a sword of Damocles because you know what this means. You know what this is saying to you. And you simply refuse it on self-consciously prejudicial grounds. I think Paul is very clear when he says non-Christians suppress the truth in unrighteousness. I think that's a much better and more biblical phrase than to say, well, unless you presuppose the truth of Christianity, you can't know anything at all. I think that really muddies the waters along the lines of Kant. So, is the real problem that a non-Christian and the Christian have nothing in common? Well, Paul's very clear, our minds are darkened. The problem is the understanding is somehow impacted by sin. It's not impacted because the wattage is different, because non-Christians are not as intelligent as Christians. The mind is darkened because non-Christians simply refuse to accept what's obvious. And therefore, they have to live a life of intellectual dishonesty. And that pushes people to use reason and normal logical thinking in wrong and improper ways. So the non-Christian has this very difficult job of trying to hold down what they know to be true and what keeps bubbling up, and they have to keep trying to, you know, it's like whack-a-mole. Truth pops up somewhere else, they've got to hit it and stop it, because if they don't, it's going to... That's the situation which the non-Christian finds themselves. So the problem is fallen human nature. People reject what God reveals. They suppress the truth in unrighteousness because our sinful nature causes us to reject evidence that is right before our noses. Now, at the end of the day, without some sort of common ground, how do we explain apostolic preaching? The apostles don't go, you know, to Christians only. You know, it's not like they have a revival where, you know, only Christians are present. And, you know, they actually take the gospel out to the agora, the marketplace, challenge non-Christians at every turn, and challenge them to believe that they would have nothing and could be nothing were they not created by God, and that God sent Christ who was raised from the dead. There is common ground. If there isn't, then the gospel is some sort of subjective authoritarian position that is unverifiable and utterly subjective. And then you're right back stuck with resolving the Montgomery-Boltman logjam. Why is Boltman wrong? And how can you show that he's wrong? Well, you can't. He just has different presuppositions. I'm not satisfied with leaving it at that. I think it's rather preferable to give him a bloody nose or two. I think that's a good point. So, Sproul and Gerson, throughout this process, will argue now for the law of non-contradiction, causality, and the basic reliability of sense perception as specific elements within common ground. And here they're very clearly echoing Thomas Reed. They write, certain assumptions regarding the knowing process, for example, are virtually universal. The assumptions are shared by theists and atheists alike, particularly when they're applied outside of the emotion-laden debate about the existence of God. We're searching for assumptions which are neither arbitrary nor subjective. In other words, we're searching for first principles, which function by practical necessity, are objective, and are non-negotiable in any discussion of truth. So there's just a loud echo here coming from, you know, Reed and the others who are saying, look, we have to assume certain first principles are in place or we can't talk about anything. The basic assumptions are the law of non-contradiction, the reliability of validity of causality, and the basic reliability of sense perception. So we're right back to the point we've been making all along, that God made the world and he made us fit to operate within it. He's made us as image bearers and creatures who think a certain way and who come to the truth of things in a certain way. Why? Because that's how God made it. And to reject the Christian faith is to have to use the very things you're denying to be true. And so this means that every time a non-Christian raises an argument against the Christian faith, they're guilty of suppressing the truth. They're guilty of using God's revelation against him. That's why they're held accountable for their actions. So, when we come to these just basic principles of common sense, Sproul and Gerstner find three, and I think these are the three most basic. The law of non-contradiction. So, A cannot be A and not A at the same time and in the same relationship. So that's a basic fundamental of the law of logic. Aristotle defined it as following in his Analytics. The same attribute cannot at the same time belong and not belong to the same subject in the same respect. And that's a pretty basic definition. Sproul and Gerstner say, the law of non-contradiction is the foundation upon which all rationality is established. It is as crucial for theology as it is for all other intellectual disciplines. It creates the dimensions and prescribes the limits of all common ground for discussion. It is a necessary precondition for any and all science. The law of non-contradiction is the principle of rationality and as such is neutral with respect to content. So here again is the Reed versus Kant. Those on the Sproul, Gerstner, Reedian side of things, Warfield, Hodge, Machen, will say that the law of non-contradiction has no content. It's a principle that brings no baggage. It's applicable universally throughout the world. Frame will say, as he did, and we quoted him a couple weeks ago, that, wait a minute, the law of non-contradiction carries with it a subjective determination as to what will be true using it. And I think here's where Reed's pretty helpful. Whoa, this isn't a choice of moral right or wrong. This is the use of a principle which we have to use to prove anything at all, including the statement you just made. So this is upstream from the stuff that Frame wants to say is dependent on it, or is implied by it. So the law of non-contradiction is a principle of rationality and as such is neutral with respect to content. By itself, it carries no brief for or against theism. It is empty of content. If we declare that 2 and 2 are 4, we're merely observing that there's a rational mathematical relation between 2 sets of 2s on one side of the ledger and a 4 on the other. Now, as I look back at this quote, I think I should have left that sentence out because what Sproul and Gerstner do here is muddy the water by importing mathematics into the discussion of law of non-contradiction. And I think the discussion of math is probably better left to the mathematicians, and let's remove that from the table, even though we could say mathematics is part of the imago, probably music and some other things as well that are kind of wired into us and the connections are pretty obvious. But here they're bringing in another category that gets confusing. But the two sides balance in a formal relation of coherency. The primary role of non-contradiction, in particular in logic in general, is the provision of a guide to coherency and a formal test for truth claims. So you recall way back when we talked about the test for truths, we have coherence, which is a negative test for truth primarily, and correspondence, which is a positive test for truth. So in this sense, the law of non-contradiction, when used, tells us that if something is self-contradictory, it cannot be what? It can't be true. The law of non-contradiction, Sproul and Gerson are going to say, is foundational for any human knowledge, whether regenerate or unregenerate. Now, I think it's something I haven't explored, and when I get the time somewhere down the road, I'd like to. Common to some of the ancient theologians, some of the modern Reformed theologians, Herman Bovink has a really good discussion of this. Part of the reason or explanation for human rationality is the present work of the Logos. There's kind of a subtext in Reformed theology that one of the present ministries of Christ is the illumination of all human minds, all human thinking. That the Logos is continually illumining everyone from the prologue to John's Gospel. So, illumined by the Logos, and I hate to just leave that line there, I really would like to explore that, but I didn't and should. Humans as rational, and yes, non-Christians have to be seen as rational because we don't regard them to a threat. We don't regard non-Christians as a threat to themselves and others as they reject Christianity. Humans as rational utilize this deductive first principle of formal logic. So to make any sense out of reality, to live any moment in time and in space, to get home from work, to have dinner on the stove, to watch any movie, to read any book, to do anything, we have to utilize this law. Hence the Christian and the non-Christian both utilize this as common ground. We have the law of non-contradiction common. Now, there's a sub-line here that I think it's worth exploring just even momentarily, is when people like Gordon Clark and other Reform writers will say that the laws of logic are presupposed by the Bible or revealed in the Bible, my hand goes up and says, well, what about somebody who's a non-Christian? Where do they get the laws of logic? Where do they come from? Well, it's borrowed capital. Well, are the laws of logic implied or revealed in special revelation? What does that say to people who live before special revelation was given? The other thing I think we have to say is we don't institutionalize non-Christians for becoming a threat to themselves and others because they're irrational. I know a lot of non-Christians that are perfectly rational. They utilize the law of non-contradiction. They're not crazy. They're not a threat to me. They're not a threat to themselves. And I think we get a little close to kind of a hyperbolic overstatement when we use language that, well, non-Christians aren't thinking God's thoughts properly. They're not in one sense, but they are in others. And the fact that they are is what makes them guilty. So we don't institutionalize non-Christians who reject the Christian faith. And dare we admit it, there are many non-Christians who are more rational and logical than Christians we know. That's because it's part of our wiring, it's part of our common ground. All right, next comes the law of causality. This is what motivated Reed to start writing philosophy because of his disgust with David Hume. Hume made the case that causality is that third thing between the billiard ball and its movement when the billiard ball hits it. We can't observe causality. And so Hume goes on to say, we have to just assume that it's going to happen every time, even if we can't prove it. Reed was not satisfied with that, of course, and I think that the joke on Hume that Reed kind of playfully throws back at him is, I presume, Professor Hume, that you still play billiards. Even though it's possible that the billiard ball is going to fly off and orbit the planet when you hit it with a cue ball, it doesn't and it never will. That's what motivated Reed to come out of his study and go after Hume. Now, the law of causality is defined very simply again by Sproul and Gerstner. It is an important element of all scientific examination. It involves a temporal element in that it concerns the quality of motion we call change. It observes the before and after of continuous actions, events, or states. Causality is established on a more firm foundation if this is seen to be an axiomatic corollary of the law of non-contradiction. In other words, these things all stand and fall together. Its definition is tautological. Every effect has to have a cause. So, what do you do with things that you can't see, like causality? So flip it around as Reed would do and say, what do you get if there is no causality? You live in a world where I'm not sure when I push the gas pedal, my car's not going to explode. I'm not sure when I get in an airplane that the laws of physics are going to be operating today. You know, you become pushed, you're forced into this kind of bizarre, weird skepticism you would never have until some philosopher raised the ridiculous question. This is Reed's point. These are things you just do. You use this constantly without ever thinking about it. And you instinctively know when someone contradicts themselves or says A is A and not A at the same time and in the same relation, that they're just nuts. The same with causality. Who on earth would question this? Only a skeptic. And Hume's skepticism, of course, is driven primarily by his offense at Christian miracles. So the subtext in Hume is his concern about the truth of the Christian faith and his reason to argue against it. So Sproul and Grusner make the following comments. The term effect carries within itself the notion of cause. Because we use the principle of causality to explain and examine observable phenomena does not mean that causality itself is derivative of sense perception. And here they are arguing against Hume. It is logically prior and necessary for the very discrimination of the phenomena. Thus we follow the procedure of asserting causality as a first or self-evident principle. Like the law of non-contradiction, it is something which in fact all believe because all must believe it to function as human beings. So, is the cue ball going to fly off and orbit this? No. You would never even think that unless some philosopher raised that question. Now, the Bible everywhere assumes causality as a testimony of God's existence. Why? Because God is the first cause of all things. That's, again, pretty self-evident. Paul, for example, makes great use of what we call in Greek a hina clause. A hina clause is simply a causally oriented term, a causally oriented term that appears in our English Bibles as therefore or because. Sproul and Grusner note, quote, consider the process of Nicodemus in his nocturnal visit to Jesus. Rabbi, we know that you're a teacher come from God. For, gar, because, no man can do these signs that you do unless God is with him. So here again, the effect presupposes a cause. Nicodemus was engaged in causal thinking, seeing the imprimatur of God as a necessary condition for Jesus' ability to perform miracles. There again is a point where I think Sproul and Grusner are of the mindset you have to establish miracles. You have to establish God's existence to establish miracles. And I think the resurrection works just the opposite. But that's another story for another time. But they go on to say, his mode of reasoning, Nicodemus's mode of reasoning, received the implicit endorsement of Jesus and the explicit endorsement of the New Testament use of the word sign. Now, the signs which John records would have no significance apart from the assumption of causality. The term sign, semeion in Greek, occurs 73 times in the New Testament and is frequently related to two other very causally loaded terms, dunamis power and ergon work. So Jesus' authentication will take place when God does something or causes something to happen in relation to Jesus, which will prove that any doubt concerning his divine authority is wrong. All of that is to say, Jesus is self-authenticating. He claims to be the Son of God, and then he does the things that only the Son of God could do to prove that what he says is in fact correct. So, the signs that he performs, are they testimonies to non-Christians? Well, that's not their intention. Their intention is to show that he is who he says he is. But if a non-Christian sees Jesus perform a miracle, what's their response going to be? Whoa! And they will call him, apart from the eyes of faith, a miracle worker. They won't see those miracles as accreditation of his claim to be the Son of God. They'll see the miracles as wow, did you see that? That guy, I can't believe it. It would have a different, but they don't deny the fact that he performed a miracle. So the self-authentication of Christ, which is a large point that our presuppositional friends want to make, that Jesus is self-authenticating, again, the question I always ask is, well, how does he self-authenticate? He says that he's the Son of God and then proves it. And proves it in such a way that the Bible everywhere assumes this causal language, that the Son of God does certain things as effects of the cause, the Father, working in and through him. So Christians and non-Christians then have that first principle in common, the idea of causality. Mind you, one of the things that Reed does with this against Hume is Reed will say, causality is something that is part of our agentic power, which is a kind of an expression Thomas Reed uses. God has made us as agents that have powers suitable to our being creatures in a world that God has made. In other words, as image bearers, we're given intellect and power as agents to cause things. So when you're 3 months old and you're starting to reach up for the first time and bat the mobile hanging above your head, and you keep doing that over and over and over again, we just learn that smacking something causes it to move. That causality is something that is in the universe, and we learn our connection to it by the fact that our decisions and actions cause things. They produce effects. So there is no skepticism that Hume would argue. We just do it, and we see it borne out all the time. The things we do produce effects. We have power as agents to cause things. And that's just part of being human. So, again, the irony just strikes me when you argue that. Here we live in a time, in a world filled with materialists who argue that the only reality is material. There is nothing that's immaterial. And here we are as Calvinists, yet again, arguing for genuine free agent, agentic power as creatures against materialists who are saying, no, 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 all you are is, what, 120 pounds of chemicals, some water, and electrical impulses sparking all over the place with no ability to explain any agentic power. And here we are as Christians, you know, arguing the case that, no, part of being an image bearer is God made me with a will. He made me an agent that has creaturely freedom. I can do things that creatures do. I always do them after the fall for sinful motives and for sinful reasons, but I still do them and can do them. So, the Lord has a sense of humor. Then finally, we have to assume the reliability of sense perception. This one is pretty much poo-pooed in the modern world, especially by some of the guys in our own camp, but it is a working presupposition if we have knowledge of the external world. It's part of nature. It's part of the order of knowing, simply because it's part of our being made as physical, sensory-equipped creatures. God made us with senses. And he made us with senses to observe and interact in the world around us. We see, we hear, we smell, and so on. It's how we are made. I hate to keep going back to Reed, but one of the most interesting discussions Reed has is a discussion on smell and taste. Apparently, oranges were rather a new thing in Scotland when Reed was writing. This was a kind of a treat. And Reed asked the question, you know, taking a direct shot at Plato. When I bite this thing that has this weird crinkly skin and I taste it, does it trigger in my mind the ideal form of orangeness? Or am I tasting the thing? When the aroma wafts off that, is it triggering in my mind this primal form that I had way back when in eternity, and now my soul's trapped in a body, it recalls to mind the perfect form of orangeness? No, I taste the orange. I smell the orange. Case closed. Philosophers don't like that, but I think that's exactly the right answer to that question. We're sensory creatures. That's how God made us. We taste the orange, and it tastes like, what? An orange. So the problem here is, our senses are fallible and limited. And so we speak of the basic reliability of sense perception, not the infallibility of sense perception. We get stuff wrong a lot, but that doesn't cripple us. Now, humans created in the image of God retain a sense of divinity, and we have the necessary mental equipment we have the cognitive faculties that make content knowledge from sense perception possible. So these are the first principles that enable us to interact with the world around us and to actually know it. Now, when you stick your pole in your pool to brush the leaves, you know that even though your eyes are telling you the pole bends, you know that's an illusion created by the way the sun hits the water and you see the pole. Your mind doesn't say, wow, the water bent the pole. And when I pull it out again, the air must have pushed it back the way it was before. We have the ability to see that even though our perceptions aren't often correct, we can kind of recalculate and figure out and not be crippled by that. We do possess this kind of knowledge, and we do have these bare-bone first principles that have theistic implications, because how would we know that? What faculty is within us that enables us to do that? Where does that come on an evolutionary materialistic model? There's just no other possible explanation for it other than the Lord created it. Now, what Reed was onto, and I think Sproul and Gerstner are trying to get at the same thing here, is that we have to trust our senses unless and until we have reason not to. So we know that our senses don't work as well in the dark as they do in the light. So when we go into a dark room, we tend to be a little more careful. We tend to stick our hands out because we know that our perceptions are limited sometimes by the world around us. But we're not at all... How many of you can navigate around in your house at night despite the fact you can't see? Yeah, pretty well, actually, I think. So Reed was right. Unless there is some reason to deny them, like I have an injury to my eye, or I'm getting old and I don't see as well, I need corrective lenses, or my hearing is going. You know, we have the awareness that senses have weaknesses, but we compensate, we're able to correct, and we still function perfectly well. So the basic reliability of sense perception is something we just all have to depend upon. The non-Christian will find themselves, just as Christians are, trusting their senses, getting around the world the same way we do, getting around in a darkened room the same way you do. They get along in their homes at night just as well as you do in yours with the lights off. This isn't a Christian versus non-Christian thing. These are things that we have fundamentally in common because we're all divine image bearers. We're all made to navigate the world that God has made for us. So that's a good point upon which to quit. I'd like to get into the next section, but it's about 10 minutes long, and we're about out of time. We'll do that next time. We'll wrap up our discussion of common ground and sense perception, and then plow into what I think is one of the most important discussions we can have in a class like this, and that is the nature of faith and reason. So we're going to wrap up our time doing philosophy, and then for the extended period, we're going to be doing systematic theology. We'll talk about faith and reason and what the scriptures actually say about faith and how that relates to reason, how faith relates to its object, which is a really important discussion to have. And then we'll get into, after that, a discussion of the work of the Holy Spirit, which is another vital topic that should be thoroughly covered.